Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Okay, I'm here with Bruce Norris. This is the Bruce Norris radio program. And my name is Sean Watkins. And I'm here with my partner, Angel Bronskiest. And what we're doing is interviewing Bruce Norris. Bruce Norris, you've heard him interview countless people on the topic of real estate investing, not only in Southern California, but how things worldwide really are affecting the things we need to look for. And in the last segment, Bruce, we were talking about now you have to look much wider than you did before. And what I'm to clarify that, to bring people up to speed, you said now, as an example, you're having to look at, you know, midnight listening to Squawk Box to find out what's going on with the global policy in Greece and how the GDP chart now would look. In other words, if one thing happens, if a tree falls in the forest and no one's there to hear it, does it affect our real estate market?
Yeah.
And can we find other events that do that? You and I talked a little bit before I came down here today about one-time events.
Mm-hmm.
How have those started to play into the way that you look at charts?
Well, see, that's really one of the themes of this next new report is the contemplation of, okay, California did exceptionally well in real estate, twice as good as the nation. Because right in the beginning of the 70s, say 73, California median price was $3,000 higher than the nation. 6 years later, it was double. Okay, so why did that happen? Was that one-time events? And so yes, I started tearing that up. So I became like devil's advocate. Will this ever happen again? Have we run out of one-time events? So some of the one-time events are profound. The baby boom generation growing up and going through their earning more, ever more money. The emergence of a two-worker family that starts to dominate instead of be the unusual. Women getting paid closer and closer to what men are making. All of those things put money into the household. The emergence of legislation saying that you can't discriminate against a minority. So that group of people now join the fray. Well, you play that out for two or three decades. Is that a new event anymore? No, it may have peaked out, as a matter of fact.
Right.
And so there's 35 of those, actually. So you have to think about that going, okay, well, was that the driver, or is just real estate this really cool thing that everyone will always want absent those drivers? And so that's the task of this report. And there's, I mean, the first chapter in this report is dealing with the numbers. And the title is The Numbers Are Compelling. I can't find any chart that discourages me from buying something and going long. I just can't, you know.
Right.
But can that be trumped by legislation changes on how people qualify? If you have a mandatory 20% down, if you take away tax benefits, if you change Prop 13, all of these things I'm going to throw at and give a numerical equivalent to damage. Okay, so let's say that this no longer exists. Well, the Obama speech last night was interesting about the tax. You know, Romney's taken a lot of heat about he makes $22 million and files a perfectly legitimate tax return and pays 15% because it's exactly the right income for the tax law.
Right.
So now they're going to change the tax law. Well, if they do that, that means capital gains is going to shift to a normal rate. But real estate has this really cool toy called 1031 exchanges. So you might start thinking, I wonder if we benefit by that.
Right.
So more people will do buy and holds and just hold it. Or people will do 1031 exchanges and avoid it. And, you know, if you're thinking about budget, how are we going to balance this budget? You could really use a boom. Stock boom would be pretty cool because that creates a lot of now revenue, you know, more
exactly.
So than a real estate boom, actually. Real estate booms create equity withdrawal.
Exactly. Well, and it's, you've mentioned that, you know, time. I wrote down time versus money during our last segment when we talk about people. It's more important to know when to get out than it was to know when to get in. In other words, you could survive a mistake by getting in a little bit late.
Absolutely.
But you could get financially and psychologically destroyed by getting out too late. I think that holds very true for the way that real estate investors see the length of their real estate investments. So much to say that there are quite a few investors out there that I don't think treat real estate as an investment, but more as a speculation. Mm-hmm. They somehow equate investment with a buy sell business. And if you could tell me how you equate, you've mentioned in a couple of answers here about nothing would discourage you right now that you've seen from buying any real estate and going long.
That made sense monthly.
That made sense monthly.
Yeah.
Tell me, in your opinion, why is it taking so long for so many investors to see the benefit of the term of their investment rather than focusing so much on how much they can squeeze out of that darn thing in 90 days?
Well, it's slower. I mean, you hit it early. We are really a society of tweets and, you know, everything's fast, instant. And we just came off of real estate that taught us that that was possible. And now we're wanting that back really bad. And especially if we have to make up lost ground. That's the scariest thing for me is, doing a talk and then having someone come up to me and say, you know, I lost $1 million in a downturn. I got to make it back right away. Uh-oh. Mm-hmm. That's a formula to make sure you lose whatever the rest you have. You know, we're not used to thinking that way. And we're not used to having a California, for instance, that rewards the practice because it doesn't usually cash flow. It usually goes up. And so now we're having to adjust our thinking, and that's just, you know, it's a hard adjustment to thinking, this is the point of the report too, is that would you want to own this if it wasn't going to appreciate? It's really trying to prove mathematically, not one way or the other. In other words, just to provide a set of proofs that says this is what real estate returns if it doesn't go up in California, but ultimately you just have a balance of zero at the end of the day. Okay. And so would you want to own it? And that's a worst case scenario, is that you just end up owing nothing. And is that okay? If that's okay, then, you know, you'd have to sign up for some of this stuff because it's probably going to do different than that, because you do have that demographic side. Are we ever going to have 50 million people here? Yeah, probably. We don't have 15 million vacant homes. So, okay, now you really do have a cost. And this is one of the coolest charts that I've never seen anywhere, is a history of the difference between prices of new homes and existing homes. And it's another proof at a peak, because the only times those charts have converged where the existing inventory is above new is in those silly years like 06 and 89.
Yeah.
Because builders didn't meet the demand and all of the pricing pressure went to the existing inventory and blew it up. Well, that's a pretty cool chart to know that, uh-oh. So it's like the peak of exuberance. You go, okay, we'll see you later. Well, exuberance is now a distant memory.
Right.
And so you're really having to look at real estate as a much longer term investment. And people are, it's not as fun.
Right.
Or sexy, you know. It's just like, yeah, how many 150 property cash flows do you have? You know, so much easier to go, I made 50 grand on my last new flip,
trust me, I'm chuckling because that was my forte. I took charts that you presented, and you presented a class, and in this class you talked about other markets.
Yeah.
That what do other places do when California is doing like this? And I took that information out of state in 2004 and found where those prices converged, where the new inventory was actually less than the existing, because there wasn't any.
Mm-hmm.
And the builders made that a reality by making their stuff so hot, their lot reservations so desirable, that it made the existing inventory, everybody had to have it, because, and you had to sell it, because the builder said, if you want ours, you've got to sell your current house in 30 days.
Mm.
Well, there was an opportunity there, but it didn't last very long, because pretty soon you had lots of new inventory. And of course, what happened? The air came right out of that balloon, and it was in the Phoenix market where you see where that happened now.
Well, it was driven by different dynamics in California usually, is because you had migration of money.
Yes.
Where California gets driven by migration of people.
You had those equity refugees who were taking money out of California and trying to dump it anywhere else.
Yep.
And the main focus was, I mean, there were busloads of people getting off these in order to make the quick dollar, because it became kind of one of those badges of honor that you wore. Look at what I made. Look at my big check. And they were great to cash those checks. I participated in that just as much as anybody else. But there's that what I like to call the hangover. The real estate hangover is when you wake up and you realize, man, that was a great party, but there are not any more of those parties. They're fewer, harder to find. You got to spend a lot more money to get into them. And somehow we started taking more and more risk, thinking that if we just risk a little bit more, mm-hmm. we could somehow recreate what we'd done in the past. And it just flat stopped.
Yeah. And it's human nature. I mean, that's the part of when you learn the statistical side, you're not home yet. Because yeah. Cal Poly Pomona has put together the statistics and drawn conclusions exactly 180 degrees of mine almost every time. Mm-hmm. And the last time I'm on their board now, and the last time that the gentleman did the quarterly, he said something about this chart, and he looked at me, he says, you probably see something completely different. And it was true. I actually, that particular chart, I had drawn a completely different conclusion. I didn't say it in front of the audience, but it was true because there was an emotional component that wasn't statistical. That's why you can tell. That's why that moodometer is a pretty good mathematical model because it measures, it doesn't measure capability. That's affordability. It basically measures your desire to do something, and your capability could be sky high. Like right now, affordability is sky high. Almost everyone is capable of owning something, but your desire quotient is at zero. You don't want it. And that's why you find no price support, no push of price at 4% interest rate, because no one wants this stuff. So right. As a contrarian, though, you know, you look at that and go, is that always going to be true? History says no. You're going to want this stuff as bad as you ever did. It's just going to take time, and then we'll be up at that low number of affordability. And at that point, that ride will have been a lot of fun.
Right.
It's just you have to, at some point, get in when other people are going, I'll never touch real estate again. So that the you need that capitulation moment for the bottom to exist. And again, the bottom, actually, it doesn't matter. You could be 2 years from now, and you probably would only miss some small rise, but you would miss the cash flow if you decided to buy something that worked. So, you know, I'm, as an investor, I have that side that I have where it's not going anywhere. And then we have a buy-sell business that's completely different.
Right.
And those two exist independent of each other. One's personal, one's a business.
But it's nice to have those two divisions because you can see what's happening in one and draw conclusions for the other business.
Well,
clearly.
Yeah, but a better reason for me is I have to make no urgent decision because the other world exists.
And that's very...
I don't need one dime to exist anew for me to live everything I want. And so that makes this group of decisions really sane because I don't have to catch up.
You're talking really an arm's length transaction now because you're not pulling that in saying, oh, if I don't make my bills this month.
Exactly.
We talked about that. Anytime you're making a decision based on, oh my gosh, it's almost the end of the month and I need to make my bills, that you're going to make a mistake because you want that much more than the person sitting across the table from you.
Yeah. If you're there, you have to be really good at faking that you're not. I mean, if you really are there, I've certainly had times in my life where I have been, you know, to negotiate from that weakness is a pretty poor stance.
That's an uphill climb at that point.
Well, yeah, because that comes across, I think, you know. And I, you know, it's the model has changed because we're buying a trustee sales, so we're not dealing with people. But if I was dealing with people directly, I think they'd pick up that I really could care less if I bought the house today. It doesn't matter to me. So let's talk and see what you got. And, you know, I mean, that's a pretty powerful position to come
from. I agree,
from.
But you mentioned trustee sales, and I think that there are people at the trustee sale that you're playing against, and those are the other buyers.
And are and motivated, and we let them have them.
Yeah, one thing you taught me at your boot camp when we went there is and you pull it off better than anyone I've ever met, Bruce, the complete nonchalant, completely you almost have a disdain when you're looking at your papers at the sale. I've watched you do it, and it's classic because you look at the paper, you're just kind of, is it time for lunch yet? And if you get it, you get it. I've never seen you even flinch at the buy. Now, how long did that take for you to develop?
Wow.
Was that just something that you had?
I don't even know I had it.
Oh, so, I've watched it, so.
You know, one of the things that we did one time was we taped an auction. And this was not a trustee sale, but an auction where they were auctioning off five new homes. And that was fun because I was controlling the auction and actually didn't know it. And A.D. Kessler actually watched the video. He says, "Do you realize what you were doing?" I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "You were completely in control of that entire auction. The auctioneer was not. You were. You controlled every final bid, every decision, every you stopped the bids, asked questions. You really messed with the guys." Like, I didn't mean to. Partly, I couldn't hear because he was, you know, how they read.
Oh, right. As a ramble.
Okay, who's high bid? I mean, I asked him that almost every house. I wanted to make sure my bid was still good because, you know, how you might have said 35 grand and he was 36, 37.
Flew right past you.
Well, yeah. Did somebody say 36? I didn't see it. No, you're still 35. Okay. Well, then you stop the momentum. So you really got to go back to 36 and fess up. Okay, there really wasn't any 36. Anyway, I don't really mean to do that, but I learned a lot. Oddly enough, you know, I got good at attending auctions because I observed them first.
Okay.
I went to the back of an auction many times before I was a bidder, when early in the 90s they started becoming prevalent. And I just observed companies do it right and wrong. And so I really understood when I saw a flawed auction about to happen. And so all of a sudden I kind of got excited when I saw one completely blown. And I realized, wow, there's an opportunity here. So I looked at all those HUD houses and went to the HUD auction and rewarded on the third property. You know, I bought something at 40 cents on the dollar, and it was it's interesting how life changes. I didn't need loans up until then, you know, because I wasn't buying enough to exceed my cash or credit lines, and all of a sudden I'm buying 10 HUD houses.
Right.
Going, where's a guy like Craig? I didn't know Craig, but I had an employee. I said, "Door knock every lender until we find somebody that wants my business." And so that was Craig, and that's how I met Craig. And when I met him, he told me his parameters, and I was I remember the house, it was perfect condition. I needed the hedge mode, and it was worth 85 grand. I bought it for 34. And so I asked Craig, "What's the loan program?" 65% of value. I said, "Fine, get it appraised." Came back at 85. I said, "Does it bother you? You're going to loan me more than I paid for it." And he was, "Yes." But that was the start of our relationship and expansion of my business. And then it is odd because I never thought about being in the hard money loan business. It wasn't. Except for it sort of backed its way into it. As you teach people and they become successful, they start asking you, "Do you have any money?"
Well, that leads to a very commonly held belief, at least I believe it, that the money follows the deal.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's – people usually do it the opposite. You know, I can't tell you how many phone calls as an investor I've gotten is, you know, if I find something, you know, count on your support for whatever. And I said, yeah, it's a very same conversation. It's a much better thing to call me up with a deal that you're nervous. It's so good, but you don't want to lose it. Then you'll find that money, but you've got to go through that. Can I find it? Because most people don't ever do the effort. That's the first part, is they're not going to really do the effort to find the wholesale deal.
Right.
The fact that you actually have one. Just, you know, in light of that, one time I actually did something where I had a deal and I put it in the LA Times in the Sunday paper, you know, block ad requesting, I have a chance to buy this house and it's worth this and da-da-da. $113 million of phone calls.
Wow.
One Sunday ad.
Not a bad ad.
Not a bad ad. It was ridiculous. It was ridiculous. You had all. I may have so misstated that. $13 million. It was $13 million, and it was like 200 grand needed. It was so many phone calls. You realize they have to have more than 200 grand, and they're calling you. So the amount of money I reached was so ridiculous.
Yeah.
And it was because I had a deal. If I had run that ad saying I think I can find deals, no one would have called.
Yeah, looking for money for something. Call me.
Exactly. You have a deal. All of a sudden, yeah. And you guys have a club. How? What are they sitting there for? Wholesale deal. So somebody stands up and actually has something? It's over.
Well, and that's the thing. You mentioned the club and the haves and wants, and I'm constantly amazed that I don't have more people rushing the front. And what that tells me is a couple of reasons. Either they're all done before they get there, which is what I believe is happening. Deals don't wait around.
No.
When you've got something, you start calling the people that you know. And for the people that are new to the business or trying to re-enter the business, I get the same, probably close to the same amount of calls that you do because of the club, of people saying, "Yeah, I really got tarred and feathered the last couple of years, but I'm ready to get back in."
Mm-hmm.
well, what do you mean you're ready to get back in? Just, what were you doing before? I've got a new idea. I've got a new thing. Same thing. Find the deal. The money will follow.
Mm-hmm.
But so many of them, the barrier of entry for a lot of them in their mind is, I don't have the cash, so I'm not going to make the offer.
Yeah. And there's some validity to the process of having proof of funds. So find proof of funds.
Exactly.
I mean, if that's the only barrier, then go find proof of funds. When I started, I didn't have the money to be a buyer. I worked for a buyer that had money. Okay, so I was basically on commission with the ability to find deals. So that worked. I mean, worked good enough to make a year's salary a month.
Yeah.
For me. So, I mean, that's one avenue that that people can take. You know, I was at a club meeting one time, and a guy actually stood up with one heck of a deal. And I was with somebody, and I got up to leave. And he says, "You're going?" I said, "I don't know why you were here. I was here for that."
Check, please. I got that one.
Yeah. I just walked up to the guy. I said, "Let's go see your deal." It was an 11-unit building for like $100,000. And done. I flipped it. All I did was pull up whoever owned all the other ones and flipped it for $60,000. That was a pretty cool one-minute meeting for me.
Well, and so that goes to show, Bruce, how much emphasis. Okay, we have a lot of technology now. What's one, and if I can limit you to one, what's the number one area that you've seen changed the most by technology over the last 20 years? In other words, one activity or one thing that you used to do this way.
Yeah.
What is that?
It's the increase of competition that can get knowledgeable very fast, pretty broad-based. ForeclosureRadar.com.
Right.
Sean O'Toole, good friend of mine at this point. Well, he has made trustee sale buying much easier. Before, you know, it was pretty tough to get all that information. Now you go to his website. Most people are there at the sales with his website open, changing bids. You don't have to phone call these, yeah, you know, trustees anymore. What a huge change. Oh, my goodness. So for $50 a month, you can sit there and be in the trustee sale business.
Now, let me ask you a question. How did you meet Sean?
That was through a club in Northern California, and that's going to be part of talking tonight, is that, you know, you asked me to come up with those five things, but it really is so many more than that, but they start the chain, if you will. So that we'll talk about that. I meet Sean O'Toole and the same thing worked for him. Okay. I'm speaking in Northern California, which ultimately led to an invitation to Washington, D.C. And I was asked, you know, if you could bring one person, well, who would you bring? I bring Sean. Well, in other words, his career, my career has all been affected by this progression of who we know and the exposure and the branding and so forth. You know, you just, that's how it works. And so knowing who's at the clubs, you know, and making friends and being trusted there. And, you know, yesterday talking to another whole different source, the agents that deal with properties, you know, there's a sort of a secret auction going to go on. And I got invited to it with an REO agent. So we're going to put up equal amounts of dough, qualify for it. It's an invitation only.
Wow.
That's pretty cool. But, you know, you have to know somebody.
Well, that's the thing, is that with all the advances we've made in technology, the thing that I keep coming back to is you have to have a balance between being willing and able to get out and meet people so they can see the content of your character before they could have the best website, the best app. But the reason you're going to even know about it or use it to its fullest potential is because you knew the person behind it.
Yeah.
And every person that I know that's been successful in REOs comes down to or short sales REOs. You can write 300 offers a day and automate it. But unless that person knows you, you're really not going to get a shot at it. We'll close out with, we've just got a few minutes here, the importance of personal relationships.
Absolutely. And, and we really are out of time, but personal relationships don't stop at talking to a seller directly. It's the REO agent that's repetitive in the short sale. Sean, I'm going to wrap up. Thank you for interviewing me, and we're going to interview Sean and Angel in our next segments.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.